What's up, everybody? Ladies and gentlemen, fire season is finally here in the United States. Yesterday, there was all sorts of activity across the western portion of our nation. And even just across the border, British Columbia continues to rip on. There are still fires poking around in Alberta. Spain, the island of La Palma in Spain had a large wildfire. And though Canada started early, the rest of the globe, our planet in which we call Earth, was a little delayed in its start for fire season when it comes to an average. But Oregon had a large fire pop off. It's the Flat Fire out of the Rogue Siskiyou National Forest. It's incredibly steep. It has more poison oak than Los Angeles has homeless people. And I'm hoping the hotshots and firefighters who end up going in and working that fire don't have too many weeping wounds from that poison oak that we all know is there. Like I said, it's incredibly steep terrain. This fire, again, the Flat Fire, started just outside of a local campground that was in the area and has since taken off. The Flat Fire was first reported at 6 p.m. yesterday, and there were high winds in the area. They had fire weather warnings. There's red flags in the area today, and they're saying it started near the Oak Flat Campground. It's already pushing 3,000 acres by the end of today. I wouldn't be too surprised if that doubles. There's some footage that I put up on social media that shows incredible fire activity coming out of this area. A Type 2 team has been ordered. Initially, a Type 3 team was in command of the fire, but due to the complexity, the terrain, all the resources coming in, that was upgraded to a Type 2. I don't believe they've taken over the fire yet. And again, this is Sunday morning that I'm talking to you and recording this, but I believe they will be in place here soon enough. Some repellers showed up early, but by the time they were set up, this thing was already ripping up the mountainscape and taking off. There are all sorts of other fires happening as well. Idaho has popped some lightning fires in the last week or so. Arizona had a big bust of wildfires go through. And California, of course, has seen some fires as well. One started by a vulture that was electrocuted on a power line, and then its cooked corpse fell to the ground and then started a fire. I wrote an article about that on the Substack. You can check that out at thehotshotwakeup.substack.com. That's also where you can go to support this show, and I appreciate everybody who does that. Let's kind of dive into what's been going on around the nation. We are at a preparedness level 2 nationwide, but I don't think that will last much longer. Now that we have multiple regions that have started to see some significant wildfire activity. There were 109 new fires yesterday, 6 new large incidents. The growing number of uncontained large fires is what will also increase that preparedness level nationally. Currently, there are 18 uncontained large fires in the United States with 2 Type 2 IMTs committed. Down in the Southwest, they are at a PL3. And again, they had some lightning come through just in the last 24, 48 hours. A bunch of fires started, some a little bit bigger, some a little bit smaller. But then again, we're not seeing the monster Southwest fires that we saw last year. There's the Campbell Fire sitting at 1,100 acres. That grew by about 600 acres yesterday. 3 crews on that. Current cost $585,000. The Pilot Fire, this is the fire that's being managed for resource benefit. It's the largest fire down there except for this Pass Fire that is also being managed for resource benefit. The Pilot Fire is 34,000 acres, and they are starting to get containment on that, but it's burning in a very remote area in a northwest district of Arizona near Wickiup, and it's grass and brush. It's this desert type fuel that fire has been burning in. That's a cost of $1.1 million. The Pass Fire is 60,000 acres now, but containment is growing on that. That has a total cost of $6.1 million. Now, just in the last 24 hours, there's been these lightning starts that have started to pop off down there. In Arizona, they had the Rim Fire that started yesterday. there's a Mesa View fire, and these two are both very small initial attack type lightning fires that haven't grown so much yet. There's a Pima Gap fire. That's 300 acres, again, in the same area down in Arizona. And then the Bullpen fire at 565 acres, all down in Arizona. Some resources have been shuffled around to go help with these fires. The Bullpen fire sitting at a cool $500,000 at this point in time. In the San Carlos Agency, it's a Bureau of Indian Affairs jurisdiction, and that's 20 miles northeast of Globe, Arizona. Now, as we talked about in the Pacific Northwest, there is that flat fire. That's going to be a very expensive fire. There's going to be a ton of people on it. I'm sure there's the possibility of crews doing multiple roles. This will be the first, really, campaign fire, I believe, in the United States. You could argue that the pilot fire in Arizona was that, but they didn't really have very many people on it. And the Pass fire, same thing, not a lot of people on it. They're going to send the world to Oregon here in the next 24 hours. There's this Mount Hood fire. It's the Boulder fire. That is one of the Type 2 teams that is out and working. That's 6 miles southwest of Dufour, Oregon. Beautiful fire underneath Mount Hood. Currently 233 acres. There's 408 people on it, and that already has a bill of $5 million. Northwest Team 10 is on that one, and the flat fire, the folks that have their work cut out for them here within the next 72 hours is Northwest Team 6. They've been mobilized and are moving probably to Agnes, Oregon, and then set up camp somewhere in that area. Also in Oregon, there was this Devil's Butte fire that ripped 2,859 acres. It ate up two engines. No one was injured, but the apparatus was destroyed. That's a county fire and currently $800,000. If we move over to Southern California, they had some excitement the last couple days, mostly in Riverside County, California. Kind of curious how all these fires started. There wasn't any lightning, or at least anything that I saw rolling through the area. And there was a lot of these foothill fires that started popping all over Riverside County. Again, we talk about that and discuss the growing number of arsonists that have been arrested by CAL FIRE. 149 arsonists arrested in 2021, 151 arsonists arrested in 2022, and it should be curious to see those numbers. I discussed that in an article on the Substack. Again, you can check that out at thehotshotwakeup.substack.com. But in Southern California, the biggest was this Rabbit Fire, approaching 48 hours old. Again, this is in Riverside County. It's 1 mile northwest of Eden, California. It was this grass brush type fire. It got some wind behind it and ultimately jumped a couple two-track roads and then ran over Highway 79. And they've been slamming it with people in aviation for about 48 hours now. That was 7,600 acres last reported. And as in California fashion, that fire has already cost $2 million. So right now they're at about $1 million a day on that fire. I think that will probably triple by the end of that campaign. The other interesting fire that I am keeping an eye on in California is in Yosemite National Park. It's the Pica Fire. It's 437 acres. They're calling it 50% contained. 120 people on it. And a current cost of $500,000, but it's a nice, beautiful fire. They're doing some burn operations on it. It's a lightning-caused fire in the park. And they're kind of just backing it down with some drip torches and making it look nice. And it's actually a really beautiful fire in the park doing all the work that it should be doing. There's some cool footage coming out of that fire. Those are the types of fires I wish they would publicize more than these grass fires ripping in Southern California. But I understand that when you're evacuating people and you're trying to get people out of the way, those are the ones that take precedent in the media. Colorado busted a couple more fires. They had this Chris Mountain fire that's still burning, and then a bunch of smaller fires off of highways, things like that. There was the Logan fire. They caught that pretty small. But Colorado is still in play. There's the Consolas fire up in the Northern Rockies. They're still at a PL2, but they have brought in a lot of resources to that area. That's in the Panhandle National Forest. Again, the Consolus Fire, 8 miles southwest of Lamb Creek, Idaho. Looks like a cool little fire, 314 acres, 272 people on it. And that fire has cost $3 million up in the Panhandle of Idaho. There was also the Midnight Fire that was just outside of Grangeville, Idaho. Again, small little ripper, 186 acres. And again, costing $1.2 million. They're throwing a lot of people at these fires up in Idaho to try to keep them small. And after the big fires that took off last year up there with the Moose and the other ones, there's the Four Corners fire, I believe it was. That one I could have wrong. I'm trying to pull that from memory with a little help from a bunch of espresso. But I think that's what it was called. And they're trying to keep these ones small, so they're throwing a lot of people and money at them. But they are good-looking fires, and ultimately they are doing good up there. And then Texas is still in the conversation with the Moore Peak fire, almost 1,000 acres, wind-driven grass fire that took off, and they've done a good job trying to corral that in with dozers, engines, and probably some Dauntless tankers and seats that they probably threw at that fire as well. Really, that's the operational update. If you want to jump up into what's going on in Canada, it's just inferno, and they're throwing an incredible amount of U.S. resources at it, including Canadian resources at it as well. A lot of crews are coming back to the United States from their tours up there, but there's also a lot of crews still transitioning their way up into Canada. Some crews are halfway done with their tours. Some have just been in-briefed by local resources and are getting kicked out to fires around these provinces, but there still is a lot of activity up there. It's very, very busy. Right next door, Alaska is wondering if fire season even exists anymore, but they've been incredibly slow, and I'm sure a lot of those resources, once Oregon and Washington really get underway, and it looks like that is happening as we speak, will start to move further south and start the second half of their season down in the lower 48 as they usually do. Red flags are still out in Colorado, Oregon, and Washington today, so there are chances for more significant growth of new starts that happen in those areas, and we'll all see how it pans out in the next week or so with increased temperatures. You know, it's summertime now, so the temperatures are going to rise. That's how it works. I'm looking at all these weather accounts that are like, it's almost a record temperature. And it's like, okay, well, what was the record? And they're like, 7 degrees above where it was today. It's like, okay, so it's not, it's kind of close to a record, but it isn't a record. You're kind of explaining it in a manipulating way when you say it that way. But okay, if that's how you want to say it, we can say it. But that's not taking away from the fact that it's hot. It's summertime. It's hot. There's 90 degrees. There's 100 degree temperatures. Phoenix has been very, very hot. I won't take that away from anybody. And where I'm going to be watching specifically in the next 48 hours is Idaho and northern Utah and maybe up into that Pocatello area, simply because they have a lot of dry lightning storms that are coming through and they do have hot, dry temperatures. And we're going to start seeing these fuels cure out. They do have significant growth on these fuels because they received a lot of precipitation. And really, all you need is starts. And we all know it's very easy for these things to happen, and it happens all the time. After I wrote that article on Substack about the vulture, everybody chimed in and was like, I've been to a fire that was started by a beaver. I've been to a fire that was started by an owl. I've been to a fire that was started by a bear. We've had a deer start a fire. And these things happen all the time. And if you have been a wildland firefighter and you are fighting like a sagebrush fire or a fire where you do have these rabbits and hares running around, I've seen it myself, and I know plenty of other hotshots who have seen it. People who are up there on the flank working direct, every once in a while you will see a rabbit run out of the fire and its little bushy tail is on fire and it runs into what we would call the green side of the fire where all the unburned fuel is. And you can only imagine if you have a little bunny rabbit with its tail on fire running through the forest of dry fuels, you get all sorts of little fires starting everywhere and you have to go chase them down. And these sorts of things happen as well on wildfires. People ask, like, this thing was almost caught. How did you lose it? Well, every once in a while, a little fluffy bunny runs across your line with its bushy tail on fire, and that's how you lose your flank. Like, these things happen sometimes. A lot of the times, a spot fire just rips over. Up next, we got a couple things we are going to cover. One very interesting news, again, out of Oregon. If you remember this wildfire map that was mandated, they put it together, people revolted, they pulled it off the industry, they pulled it off from public use. Now the legislature in Oregon is looking at it. Well, they set new ground rules, so we're going to cover those ground rules, and they are very, very interesting ground rules that leave a lot of gray area. And again, I see this as a sand table exercise for these governments to see how they can implement these different types of AI satellite maps and impose them on their citizens and say, hey, we're going to tax you more and you're going to lose your insurance and so on and so forth. That's some other news we're going to cover. Florida insurers, I believe it was State Farm, has pulled out of parts of Florida now and are pulling insurance from homeowners saying, due to wildfire risk, we're no longer going to insure you. So it's not just the West Coast where this is happening. It's happening on the East Coast in Florida now. And Florida is a fairly friendly fire state. Not going to lie, I was surprised to see that. I wasn't surprised to hear it in California and Colorado and Oregon and these places. Utah is another one where they've started pulling insurance. But down in Florida, they pulled it as well. We'll cover that. And then lastly, we got an update on the wages and the proposed bill that's going to go through. The Forest Service put a statement out on it. And so we're going to rip through that statement and briefly talk about that. Thanks to all the paid Substack subscribers. It's how I am able to continue doing what I'm doing. It's been busy. Now it's getting crazy busy. And trying to keep all the updates and the podcasts coming. I wouldn't say it's a struggle, but man, it takes up a tremendous amount of my time. And so I appreciate those supporters. If you want to support what I do, just go to the hotshotwakeup.substack.com, click on that subscribe button, and become a monthly member of this community. Once again, I appreciate it to all the free subscribers. There's an insane amount of free subscribers. It's incredible how many people have started to tune in and read what I do. What if you find yourself tuning in consistently, constantly, you know, checking the social media for all the updates I give and reading all the articles? Please consider a paid subscription, and that will help continue the content, the donations, and everything else that we do here at the Hotshot Wake Up. And it would be greatly, greatly appreciated. Thank you very much for everybody out there. And we'll move on to what we got going on next.
I have traveled this year over all the United States, through the Alleghenies, the White Mountains, and the Catskills, the Rockies and the Bitterroot Mountains, the Cascades, the Coast Range, and the Sierras.
So Farmers Insurance has pulled out of Florida. They're saying about 100,000 homeowners will be affected by this. And again, they are saying it's due to wildfire and inflationary issues. This, I believe, ties into what we're going to talk about right after this, which is this Oregon wildfire map that they're sticking to it, and they're going to push it through, and they're going to set new rules with it. We'll cover those rules. But I think these things are all tied together. I've been saying that for well over a year now. And it seems to be the progression of how these things are getting steered into public policy and public perception. This was out of CBS News. It says Farmers Insurance said Tuesday that it will no longer offer coverage in Florida, ending home and auto insurance policies affecting tens or hundreds of thousands of residents. Farmers becomes the fourth major insurer to pull out of Florida in the past year, as the state's insurance markets look increasingly precarious due to extreme weather events. Quote, we advised the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation of our decision to discontinue offering Farmers branded auto and home insurance and other umbrella policies in their state. This business decision was necessary to effectively manage risk exposure. We're almost on 2 years now that I've been talking about this exact topic, saying you're not going to be able to insure your home anymore. And I wasn't pulling that out of a hat, but I was watching congressional testimony where these insurance companies were sitting in front of panels of senators and representatives saying just that. in these wildfire policy meetings. They were saying wildfire is so bad, climate change is so bad that we're just going to stop insuring homes. And so it was pretty easy for me to get on the air and be like, hey, guys, like this is, I don't know how many people watch this congressional testimony, but this is what they said. They're going to stop insuring everybody's homes. Well, now it's CBS News and they're like, hey, you can't have insurance on your home anymore. Samantha Becker, a spokeswoman for the Office of Insurance Regulation in Florida, said that they received this discontinuation of insurance notice from Farmers Insurance and the details about them exiting the Florida market. The notice was listed as a trade secret, so no details will be made publicly available. So these insurance companies are going to the state committees, and they're saying, here is the memo, we're leaving your state, we're no longer going to provide insurance to the homeowners in your state due to extreme weather and wildfire. And when reporters say, hey, can we see that memo the insurance company sent? Can we see their reasonings, like the actual written reasonings why they left? It's been guarded and protected by what is known as trade secrets. And that means that it can't be made public. And the politicians and the bureaucrats who are handling this information say, no, we can't let you know what the insurance companies are saying because it's protected by the trade secret laws. Very, very interesting stuff. There's a lot of different industries that have trade secrets and say, we're not going to release, you know, trials and reports and safety and efficacy because it's a trade secret and we're not going to put it out for 50 years. You're seeing it in the insurance industry now, which is very, very, it actually is a little bit concerning that this is the sort of thing that's happening. It says Farmers has also limited new policies in California, which has seen wildfires that are being fueled by, quote, climate change. Allstate and State Farm have also stopped issuing new policies in California. If you would just read the UN report on wildfire, you would know why they're doing this. And if you would look at the $330 million that was allocated in the Inflation Reduction Act under population reduction in wildland urban interface areas, yes, $330 million of your tax dollars went to that, you would understand why these policies are slowly going into place. Again, in the congressional testimony, they said exactly why this was happening. They said they're trying to drive out people who live in the wildland urban interface and rural areas. They would like them to move into the cities where it's safer for them to insure condos and high rises and things like that. They can make more premiums on insurance doing that. This will then, you know, under the guise of protecting people from wildfire, reduce the population in these rural areas. And then ultimately, again, they said in this congressional testimony that all the rich people will move to these rural areas, buy all the houses up for cash, and then those property values will skyrocket and be harder to obtain except with large fistfuls of cash because you can't insure these homes now that are sitting in rural, mountainous, wilderness, timber-filled areas. And again, I'm not pulling this out of a hat. They legitimately said this in the testimony. There was a guy from UC Berkeley talking about this. We follow each other on social media. He's a really smart guy. And he was saying this. He's like, you wait until you see the real estate implications of all of this. So very, very interesting. And then if you move to what's happening in Oregon, and again, I was one of the first people to report on this wildfire map in Oregon that was botched and revoked and caused all sorts of controversy. And that's when I was saying, hey, they're going to start using these insurance maps for pulling people's insurance. And then the state of Oregon put out a statement saying, no, we're not going to put people's insurance policies at risk. And then on the Substack, maybe a month ago, I wrote an article about Utah getting their insurance pulled by Zions and others in that state. And the people who ran those insurance divisions were like, well, that's actually been made really easy for us because they've produced these wildfire risk maps. And so we just pull these up on our laptops and our iPads and we decide whose insurance we're going to pull. You know, it's like, duh, of course that's what they were going to do with these things the whole time. You know, if you spend enough time looking at it, you see the advantages that can be done with these things when it comes to making money for shareholders and how to optimize revenue. And when you can see that from an outside perspective, and then you start seeing these pieces come together, you're like, oh, geez, they're totally going to combine all these things and rip off the consumer and make a bunch of money. But out of Oregon, they're back at it, saying Oregon Department of Forestry set to update disputed wildfire hazard map with new legislative guidance. Now, the important thing out of this article that I want to talk about is the new guidance, and it's a lot. We'll rip through it because I still want to get to all this raise conversation that's going on. But it's all very fascinating how they stuffed all this verbiage into this new piece of legislation that they're talking about. It says that Oregon Department of Forestry, and again, this is by KTVZ News out of Salem, Oregon. It says Tuesday it will soon begin work with Oregon State University to update the disputed withdrawn wildfire hazard map, making revisions based on directions provided in the Senate Bill 80, which was passed in 2023. We covered that passage of the bill on the Substack as well. Before I continue this article, I don't want to take away from the work that the people did to create this thing, okay? I know it took a lot of work to put this thing together. I know these people are smart, intelligent folks who were said, hey, we need to build this thing, and they did. And I'm not putting anything on them. You know, they're just doing their work. They're creating a product and so on and so forth. But once it's in the hands of the government and the insurance agencies, that's where it gets a little squirrely. But I'm not putting anything on the people who created this thing. It's actually kind of a neat application. And, you know, it's important, you know, I think, to have these sorts of things, but it's a tool. And when you have a tool, it's all about how you use it, right? So if you have a hammer and someone says, open this jar of pickles, it's not the best tool for the job. You know, you just probably should find something else to open that jar of pickles than the hammer. It says, quote, the revisions this bill makes addresses the plain fact that we'll meet the massive wildfire challenge ahead only through a rock-solid collaboration between state and federal agencies, local officials, community leaders, and affected property owners. We'll succeed if Oregonians see this as their program and not the government's program. Very interesting comment by Jeff Golden out of the Rogue Valley area. He is the Senate Natural Resources Committee chair who is seen over all this stuff. And again, it's all about messaging and how they're putting it forth. It's kind of like weird 1984 doublespeak almost. When he says, we'll succeed if Oregonians see this as their program, not the government's program. Okay, so you want the citizens to take ownership of something that was kind of botched. Okay, all right. I see what you're doing there. It continues saying SB 80 takes big strides in that direction. The bill wouldn't have been possible without the careful work of the Wildfire Program's Advisory Council, 19 citizens from different backgrounds, professions, and locations who are charged with guiding us over time towards a more effective wildfire program. We're lucky to have their service. If anyone out there knows who's on this committee, the committee of 19 that has overseen Oregon's wildfire policy that they put together to try to fix this map, I would love to interview some of those people and know who's on this, their backgrounds, where are they coming from? Are they all educational people? Are any of them wildland firefighters? That's really my major question. This council of 19 that's overseeing this policy, are any of you wildland firefighters? Please reach out and let me know. That is something I would like to know out of this whole situation. It says, lack of clarity about the map's purpose and limited time for outreach and education about what it would mean for property owners resulted in concern about the opposition of the map. Hey, sorry if I fueled that a little bit, but when you guys slammed this down people's throat, it was pretty obvious that you guys should pump the brakes just a little bit. So I went out and talked about it. It says ODF plans to engage communities throughout the upcoming revisions process to better inform Oregonians on the process, the science behind it, and the purpose for the updated hazard maps. And then this is where we get into the new policy pieces of this map. It says, what are the new purposes of this map? And it says, to inform Oregon residents and property owners about wildfire exposure by providing transparent and science-based information. Okay. Assist in prioritizing fire-adapted and mitigation resources for the most vulnerable locations. Okay. Don't hate on that. Identify where defensible space standards and home hardening codes will apply. Now, that one just says, we're trying to figure out where we can tax you more and where to charge you and say that you need to do better. And anybody who's been listening for a long time knows that I like property owners who are proactive. You should clean up your property. You should clean out your gutters. You should ensure that you don't have a bunch of crap laying around your land that could start on fire and cause problems for you. You should be a steward of your own land. But now we have satellite AI-created maps that are judging where housing codes should be applied. Okay, so let's think about that. It says it changes 5 risk classes to 3 hazard classes. So they changed some language there, and then they compressed the amount of variation that you can have on your property. It says it requires 8 meetings with county and local officials to review local drafts of maps. Those should be interesting meetings. It says it limits the hazard class notification requirements to those in high hazard zones that are also inside wildland-urban interface boundaries. Very interesting. Updated notifications will be reviewed by the Wildfire Program's Advisory Council. So this Council of 19. They will have recommendations on tone, clarity of language, and presentation of information. Man, you have a Council of 19 that is judging tone and clarity of language. Very interesting. I'm not going to judge that until we see what they put out. But again, I want to know who's on this super secret Council of 19 in Oregon. They have a lot of power. It says they're making changes to the appeal process. Properties in high hazard classes may be appealed as a contested case hearing described in Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 183. Okay, so if the satellites say you have a high-risk area, and you don't think you do because you cleaned up your property, you now have to go in front of the government, and maybe even the Council of 19, and plead your case that your property is not at a high wildfire risk like this map on an iPad says it is. And then you have to go through an entire appeal process as they're trying to slam new statutes and code violations down on you. Oh, man, I love this stuff. They are saying that they're looking to publish a draft map online before they go live with all of this. I'm sure that will get a lot of attention and a lot of folks in Oregon will look at that. And it also says that they will send notifications to property owners in high hazard zones inside the wildland urban interface boundaries, including instructions on how to appeal your wildland urban interface boundary designation. Unbelievable. This is just, they're just asking for trouble. I'm going to be honest with you. They're asking for trouble. You are mandating a map that you upload onto an iPad and you zoom in and you zoom out and you look at it and it's super fancy. And again, I know it wasn't easy to create and it is a cool map to look at. But when they first came out with this thing, they said, we're not going to let insurance companies use it. We're not going to use it to raise your taxes. We're not going to use it to run you out of rural areas. We're not going to use it to force you to do this or that. Then they withdrew it and classified the tone and clarity of language with the Council of 19. And now they're setting up all sorts of appeal processes and say, hey, if you don't think you live in a wooey area, you can appeal it. And then you have to go into the court and bow your head and give your offering in hopes that the Council of 19 will relinquish their grip on the wildfire hazard that has been overlaid on top of a map via satellite and AI computations zoomed down to a laptop. I'm sure that more states will pick up on this and it will expand. It will continue to expand and people will continue to lose their insurance and be forced out of their homes if we don't, get a little bit of a handle on this, on how this is all going to be implemented. I'm here to tell you, folks, if you study history, map makers caused a lot of problems in history over the years. Someone would come out with a new map back in 1580, and they would draw some lines that went over a river and a hillside that maybe wasn't actually yours, and it had classifications and jurisdictions. And people argued over that and said, hey, I don't agree with your map. That isn't how I represent the landscape in my mind. And again, if you just look at history, we see the problems that map makers can create. It's a very powerful tool. I think that's underestimated basically by all humans on planet Earth, on how powerful maps are. It's an incredibly powerful tool. So just keep that in mind as we continue on and see what they do with this Oregon map. Again, thanks to everybody who subscribes to the Substack, the hotshotwakeup.substack.com. I appreciate it. I'm 100% ad-free, 100% sponsorship-free, and I get all of my support through that. Again, the hotshotwakeup.substack.com. Up next, we're going to talk about the Forest Service update on the pay legislation that's been proposed and what that exactly means. And they do lay it out with GS levels, how much the percentage is, so on and so forth. And I have to be the bearer of bad news because no one else is talking about it in the fire media. They're not talking about it. So I'm going to just be the bearer of bad news. And the people who refuse to be that messenger, they can thank me later. But ultimately, what it looks like is it's not going to be what everybody's hoping for. And it's not going to be as big of a raise as everybody was expecting. And no, it won't be exactly what the retention pay is that people have been receiving. Yes, it is a raise. And yes, it does add portal to portal pay in the legislation. And we're going to cover those details. Again, it's not all bad, but I have to call it like it is. It's not as good as everybody's been asking. I've made some comments on it, and my email and my inbox is crazy. There's some people in the fire world that I'm really close with, and I sometimes shoot them text messages and screenshots of what I get in my personal communications. And I'll just say there's a lot of crazy people out there, and I never would have thought they would latch on to the wildfire world, but they do. And man, there's a lot of crazy people out there sending me some really unsavory things and saying some things that are really inappropriate. And if you were to say them in public while I was standing across from you, one, I guarantee that you wouldn't say it in the first place. But hey, you know, if you want to anonymously, be a meanie head, you know, if you really just want to be a bad person, hey, go for it, because it provides me and my friends a bunch of comedy and humor throughout the day, looking at how absolutely crazy all these people are. Anyway, on to the raises. We'll cover that here in just a second. So the Forest Service put out an update on July 13th of this year talking about the wildland firefighter pay bill that was introduced in the Senate. Again, this was put out by Deputy Chief Jaleth Hall Rivera, who is in charge of the state private and tribal forestry. So this just runs through what it is and talks about what it could be and gives a brief rundown of what is actually going on. Now, a quick note, I'm sure Jaleth Hall Rivera is a very, very nice lady. I'm sure we would get along and we would have interesting conversations, but she does look like a vampire vixen from a 1980s film. I just gotta throw that out there. She looks like the gal who is in the dark bar that is seducing someone to drink their blood and continue living forever. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that's just kind of what I see. Again, Deputy Chief Jaleth Hall Rivera, I'm just joking around. And I'm sure we would have interesting conversations and get along, but you look like you're going to drink my blood. I'm just going to say that's kind of what it looks like. Anyway, I personally appreciate the update. And again, you are being straightforward about what's in this bill. But again, to be the bearer of bad news, because no one else will, it's not exactly what everybody's hoping for, but it is better than what it is before you got your retention pay. All right, let's crack through this. I actually have a gender reveal party I have to go for my family here in a little bit, so I'm going to crank through this. It says, I'm so pleased to be able to share with all of you today that a bipartisan group of senators introduced the Wildland Firefighter Paycheck Protection Act of 2023, a bill that would permanently increase base pay for the Forest Service and Department of Interior wildland firefighters. Now, I wrote an article about this legislation coming out on the Substack. All sorts of people read it. It seems like folks, at least in the wildfire world, are aware now that this legislation has gone through, or I should say introduced, and I'm interested to see if it gets passed because this fiscal cliff is coming in just a handful of weeks. In that article on the Substack, I talked about how it was introduced by John Tester, who's out of Montana, but then the week before, the CEO of Bridger Aerospace, the largest scooper company in the United States, announced his candidacy in John Tester's congressional district. And then shortly afterwards, John Tester came out with this wildfire legislation to pay firefighters more. And I cover my thoughts on that. You should check it out if you haven't read it. But I always find that interesting how the timing works on all of this. It says, the bill would also provide a new kind of premium pay, incident response premium pay for all responders. Now, we'll get to it, but there is a caveat to that. There is a little asterisk by that one. This will help ensure we are able to recognize the critical role collateral duty firefighters play in ensuring we are successful in our wildland fire mission. It says, here's the breakdown. The special salary table for wildland firefighters in this bill would enact a new increased permanent GS scale table for wildland firefighters in primary or secondary covered positions. These special base rates can also be applied by the secretary to wage grade employees who work in fire. So they're expanding it out a little bit. Now, there's going to be some verbiage and terminology that people who aren't in wildland fire or a federal employee won't understand, but we'll crank through this and get to the details. We'll start at a GS3. If you're a GS3, that's a 36% increase. GS4, 33. GS5, 30% increase. GS6, 27% increase. GS7, we're in overhead positions now, 24% increase. GS8, 21. GS9, 18. GS10, that's hotshot superintendent level, 15%. In the new classifications, they're fighting for a GS11 for the hotshot superintendents, but there seems to be some animosity towards doing that. I don't know why. I was talking to some hotshot superintendents actually just yesterday who read my post about us sending billions of dollars over to Europe to blow people up, but we can't spend a couple hundred million for our wildland firefighters. They were making comments to their supervisors kind of in the same way, and they were told directly by these folks who in the policy offices of Washington, D.C., that if we paid our wildland firefighters what they want, our country would go bankrupt and we wouldn't be able to sustain budgets. And we're talking a couple hundred million dollars. Well, that being said, we're sending hundreds of billions of dollars to Ukraine to blow people up. And I'm not trying to make this like super political or anything. I'm just stating what it is. We're sending hundreds of billions of dollars to blow people up in Europe. And they're not saying that is destroying budgets or bankrupting the country. There was incredible amounts of reckless spending during the whole COVID debacle. They are now saying straight up that $200 billion was fraudulently given out during the COVID bailouts, I'll just call them. That would pay for wildland firefighter raises for decades and decades and decades. And they're just like, oh yeah, $200 billion disappeared. Sorry about that. Didn't mean to do that. Oops. Maybe we can try to recoup it, but probably not. But they're telling hotshot superintendents that if they give them the raise that they want, which equates to hundreds of millions of dollars over a couple years, that it would bankrupt the country and destroy budgets. It's all a bunch of bullshit, and the priorities are off, and it's ridiculous that they would respond to these high-level operational folks like this. Anyway, back to the raise details that the Forest Service gave us. Again, you are getting a wage increase, that 33% at a GS-4 or a 15% at a GS-10, but it is far, far, far from what we've been asking for, and in some cases, less than what the retention pay was. But then they get into this premium pay or this portal-to-portal pay, but there's a little caveat to that as well. It says you will receive this premium pay on suppression incidents, prescribed fires as well, so that is a win. I will say that. That's a win. And employees receive this premium pay for a qualifying incident outside their official duty station or for an eligible incident within their official duty station when they are assigned to a fire camp or designated field location. So if you're on a prescribed fire in your local district, but you're spiking out, you will get portal-to-portal pay. That's what it sounds like. I think this is a typo, but I'm going to read it as it says. It says the premium pay will be calculated at a daily rate that reflects 450% of the employee's hourly rate base pay. I don't think that's correct. If it is, holy. If it is, that's crazy. But I think it's supposed to say 45%. But I'm good. Just going to read it to you as it says. It says the premium pay will be calculated at a daily rate that reflects 450% of the employee's hourly rate base pay. Again, I think they made a typo. But if you do get 450% of your base pay for portal to portal, I'm all about it. But I don't think that's correct in the way they typed it. It says these daily rates cannot exceed the maximum rate of base pay for a GS-10 Step 10. So they might be screwing hotshot superintendents right there for that. And it says the annual cap for premium is $9,000. So that, I think, is a big asterisk. Because if you work 1,200 hours of overtime, which isn't crazy, plus your premium pay on top, which is this portal to portal, once you hit $9,000 of being paid out in that category, they cut you off and then you're no longer getting it, which again, I think is bullshit and is the wrong way to go about it. And they're pinching pennies because, you know, let's say you hit your $9,000 cap for portal to portal mid-August, and then you hit the busiest part of fire season where you're working later and having longer hours, staying up later, and out more, and then that pay gets cut off. I think they should change that and really think about expanding that out. It says you will continue to receive overtime and hazard pay as currently calculated. However, the premium pay will not count towards your fire retirement calculations. Again, I think that's idiotic. They're going to pay you for it because you're out there working these hours for the government, but they're saying it won't count towards your retirement. That's horrible. They should change it. And again, it's peanuts compared to what we're using to blow human beings up across our planet. Then it gets into R&R, and it says this bill codifies the agency's current practice of providing 3 days off of R&R following a 14-day assignment. And says the bill requires the Forest Service and Department of Interior to do an assessment to compare wildland firefighters' total compensation under this framework to that in 2023 and provides the ability to make adjustments to premium pay to ensure the amounts are consistent. I hope that they do that. That is a good little caveat to have there at the end saying, hey, we're going to have the nerds pencil push and do a bunch of calculations and scratch some numbers down and see if you're making more or less than you did with the retention pay. And then they're saying they may make adjustments accordingly. I think it's important that they put that in there, and I think it's something we should hold them to a year down the line when you are making, you know, less than you were. Maybe you'll make more, but they're going to find that out and then discuss adjustments beyond that. It says they're scheduling a town hall for all employees in the future to further explain the proposed legislation and answer as many questions as you have. This thing still needs to get passed. The politicians still have to sign off on it. Again, I hope that they do. Because again, it's better than just having the fiscal pay cliff hit and nothing happen. Like, they need to get this through. They should implement the 24-hour pay. They should remove the $9,000 cap on it. And it sounds like at the end of it all, so at the end of the 2024 fiscal year, they will look back and see how the compensation compares with previous years and ultimately decide if they're going to adjust it. That's the update on that. It's not all doom and gloom. Like, I want to get that out there. It's not all doom and gloom. However, they have been kicking the can down the road. It's embarrassing. And I haven't gone to the point yet where I'm like, man, there's some agency heads that should probably resign. You know, I've had that conversation, you know, on a patio with some buddies, but I don't know if it's to that point yet. I'd be curious if folks in the industry think that's the case. Are we to that point? Do people need to start stepping down and being like, hey, we botched this whole thing. Sorry. Yes, we have made progress, but I'm going to turn the reins over to someone else. I'm curious the thoughts are, but they need to get this through and they need to pass it and they need to pay people more, plain and simple. On that note, hey, thanks again to all the supporters who are monthly paid subscribers on the Substack. You can find that at thehotshotwakeup.substack.com. I'm 100% ad-free, 100% sponsorship-free. And if you would like to participate in continuing this, please reach out and click on that subscribe button, thehotshotwakeup.substack.com. Check in on your homies that you haven't seen in a while. Shoot them a phone call, shoot them a text, see how they're doing. Go outside, get some exercise, stretch, hydrate, get the rest you need, eat those quality calories, but remember, when you get up, you gotta get it done.
For you.